As many times during the past few weeks, Iran has denied sending combat drones to Russia for the Ukraine war. But the so-called international community is only listening to the claims that are being made by the U.S., Ukraine, and European countries. Russia has also denied it. Why then is the West, after accusing Iran of something that it has not done? Is it to make up for their military failures? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what state the Ukraine conflict is actually in and why peace seems in some ways elusive. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us, author and commentator John Stempling, who joins us from Inderøy, Norway.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Stepling, first to you. The accusation, Iran has agreed to supply drones and surface-to-surface missiles to Russia. At least that's what the Americans are saying. Also, Ukraine and European officials are saying the same thing. Both Russia and Iran have denied that. What do you think about the accusation that's being leveled?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is in the habit of making baseless accusations, ones without any proof. They rarely supply any evidence or proof for these accusations. But the other question is, why is this wrong exactly? All of the EU is contributing weapons to Ukraine. The United States is funneling billions of dollars of ordnance and weaponry, and they've helped with training and so forth, all into Ukraine. It's been a massive windfall for the military-industrial complex, and it should be noted that only something like 30% of those weapons make it to the battlefield in Ukraine. And a lot of that weaponry is outdated and probably couldn't have been sold anyway, so they just give it to Ukraine. But this is the same question. Iran is always demonized. They want to have a nuclear bomb. Well, why is it okay for all these other countries to have nuclear weapons but not Iran? Who decides that? The United States always engages in a kind of rhetoric where the assumption is that they are the final arbiter of what the rules are. And
right.
And this is just nonsense. So I don't think Iran has done what they say, but I don't much care if they did. Who cares? This is a U.S. fomented crisis, 100% manufactured by the West. It was planned even before the Maidan coup in 2014, which the U.S. orchestrated. The U.S. has targeted Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. They interfered in the 96 election that they helped get Yeltsin elected, on and on. So this is just the kind of constant stream of propaganda that has been coming out of the U.S. and the West, propaganda the likes of which I have never seen. Just stunning bald-faced lies.
We need to obviously cover what both sides have said, John Bosnich. So let's take a look at what Iran has said. The foreign ministry spokesperson has said, basically rejecting this, saying it's baseless accusation. Tehran was committed to, based on his words, active neutrality and opposition to the war and the need for a political settlement of the differences between the two sides, which would be away from violence. Can't forget how about a month ago you had the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who actually delivered a message to Russia to convey from the European side, and it was said to be from actually the French President Emmanuel Macron, that, you know, let's figure out a peaceful solution to this. So that's what Iran's side is saying. What is your thought on that and, of course, the accusation?
Well, you know, everything that comes out of the mouth of America's government or its centrally controlled media, mainstream media, which literally replicate stories issued by government media outlets, everything that comes out of those mouths is pre-programmed in advance. There is an assessment made of what would be the damage or the effect of producing this propaganda news, what we might expect to do domestically with the generated public response, and what we can do internationally with the generated public response. And I say this having worked in state media in various countries around the world, and I know how this is done. So the United States, in a time of war, always faces a small but noisy isolationist factor inside its political body. And the isolationist factor benefits from arguing against war in general. So when the government of the United States faces too much internal opposition to a war, they tend to combine two demonized foes. And in this scenario, from the very beginning of the conflict in Russia, America has combined China as a guilty party for not sanctioning Russia. Now, as we see, the Americans are becoming more desperate in the conduct of the war, which is not going well for them or for their cannon fodder in Ukraine. We see them drawing in Iran as another target of historic American demonization. And the basic theory is if you can demonize three together, the people of America will be more ready for war than if you are only demonizing one party. That's what's happening now.
Yeah, a couple important points that you made there, and I'd like to ask you, John Stepling. First of all, let's get on to one of them, and that is the fact that we're looking at the way that, well, this war has had its ups and downs. But you have, on the one side, media reporting that Russia is on the back foot, that it's not doing well. On the other hand, when we get these types of developments, like these drones being thrown into the picture, accusing Iran of providing it to Russia, then some say that shows that Ukraine is not doing well militarily. So is that one of the things that's happening here? They're not doing well militarily. They've got to have an angle to go after, and they're using this.
Russia's doing fine militarily. Every report that you hear about Russian failures, desertions, incompetence, lack of weaponry, supply shortages, etc., all of it is from the Western press, and none of it is true. It's simply not true, and Russia is doing fine. They have shown enormous restraint, actually, because for a variety of reasons, but primarily because it's in their interest to do this efficiently and without, you know, a lot of shock and awe. But once the terror attacks happened, the bridge and the Nord Stream and so forth, Russia appointed a more hardline general to carry out the mission, and he sort of took the gloves off. The only country that is not doing well is Ukraine. They are running out of soldiers. They're running out of everything. The Zelensky is ever more strident and sort of petulant and almost hysterical and demanding help from the EU and the United States. And remember, there are massive protests across the EU. Nobody can afford the cost of living. There's no jobs. The West in general is facing something of an economic crisis, and you know the EU does what the United States tells it to do, and the military-industrial complex, the defense industry, makes a lot of money out of this, and that's one of the primary engines for all of this. But no, Russia's doing fine, and they will conclude this operation probably before too long. It will only, the only question remains exactly what the final terms will be with Ukraine and the U.S. It does worry. There are voices that express a great deal of worry that the United States doesn't want to feel humiliated, that a false flag is on the horizon, that Poland will get involved, there will be attack against Belarus. There are all these theories, but I don't think any of them are going to happen.
Sure. Well, the false flag is not going to be too false when the Republicans take over. At least that's what the projections are. Okay, so John Busness, you mentioned something about how they want to group Iran, Russia, and China in order to go after them as one force, perhaps, that needs to be demonized. That's a very interesting statement because we're looking at, if I can bring this up, what the State Department has said, that the deepening alliance between Russia and Iran is a profound threat that countries across the world should actually monitor. So this gives one incentive behind why perhaps this scenario is being painted of accusing Iran, et cetera. So is that what we're looking at, one of the aims of why perhaps they're accusing Iran of this?
The expanding a negative scenario for America is getting worse day by day. To try to get ahead of the wave of damage that is going to be delivered to their interests, they are now becoming aggressive. And in that sense, they accuse other countries of potential threats that they could pose without any evidence, and then begin to crank the gears of pressure on those countries as well, hoping that those countries might make a provocative act that America could use as a casus belli, as a reason to initiate another side war. And that raises the specter of world war, and therefore raises the demand for more money to be spent on the military, of which the corrupt military-industrial complex takes a massive percentage directly into their pockets. No war means no money. Mm-hmm. Big war means big money. That's the way the United States military-industrial complex rules the American government. And Biden, in that whole game, is just as much a joker as Zelensky is. Both of them are owned by the same military-industrial complex.
Indeed. Well, here's the thing, John Stepling. There's a camp out there that says, wait a minute, and I think you mentioned that in your statements, John Stepling, that what is wrong with Iran, for example, selling military equipment or drones or ballistic missiles or what have you? The camp is saying that they're disagreeing with what the U.S. and European partners are doing, is that, if anybody helps Russia, does that mean that they have to go under sanctions, that sanctions have to be placed on that country? For example, OPEC Plus comes and says 2 million barrels cut per day. So do they have to now be sanctioned? Because the way U.S. sees it, Russia is making money off of that. So let's go sanction OPEC Plus. So they're going with that approach. Do they have a right to view it that way?
Well, I mean, of course not. The U.S., it's always difficult to tell exactly if the U.S. calculations have failed or not. The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years. And, by all appearances, it was an abject failure, except that, of course, the defense industry and a lot of private security firms made massive profits out of that 20 years. They also extracted a lot of resources from Afghanistan illegally. So the U.S. sanctions Russia, thinking that was going to weaken and overextend Russia somehow. That was what the Rand Corporation paper prophesied. And it's been a stunning failure. Russia just asked that the transactions take place in rubles, and the U.S. Didn't impose any real hardship on Russia with this. And remember also, the U.S. is over the last probably since 2008, have been terribly concerned that the international reserve currency might stop being the dollar. And every time that discussion comes up, the specter of China looms on the horizon. And this is one of the primary fears for the U.S. But, the U.S. does things like help coordinate the assassination of Soleimani, They falsely imprisoned people all the way back to the breakup of Yugoslavia. I mean, we could go on and list U.S. crimes, covert, overt, all foreign policy activities that have been illegal. Mm-hmm. And yet they make a big fuss about, but Iran is selling drones to Russia. I mean, it's, you know, if it weren't such a serious situation, it would be laughable because it's just an absurd thing. And yet, you know, propaganda works. A lot of the American sure. public are up in arms about the evil Putin and the evil Russian Empire, and it's just not true.
Well, we need to talk about the military aspect a little bit more here, John Bosnich. And one thing that has been described about these drones is that they're so effective that they say it flies at low altitude, and they, I guess, Russia sends out swarms of them, and it's able to do some extensive damage. At the same time, they're saying, you know, Russia is running low on equipment. It's got dwindling supply of whatever equipment that they're running out of. So if this is working for them, then why isn't Ukraine reacting with supplies of their own? Are they coming out short themselves then? Which then points to the fact that they are weakened when it comes to the military aspect of this vis-a-vis Russia.
Well, just coming at the question from the military point of view, I've sat myself for 78 days here in Belgrade and across the rest of Serbia under American aerial bombardment every day, several times a day, with what they called smart bombs. And the entire Western world was fine with that. There was no sanctions against America. There was no such activity. Now, in the situation in Ukraine today, we have a situation in which the Russian army intervened in compliance with the Western principle of the responsibility to protect an ethnic minority of Russians who were under pressure from American-backed military forces attacking civilians. Russia has intervened after waiting 8 years of this kind of genocidal activity. The idea that Russia, during that period, would not have been able to produce its own drones or to copy under license and mass-produce drones that perhaps may have been designed in Iran in the past is inconceivable, because the Russian defense and military production industry is many tens of times faster, bigger, and better equipped than the Iranian military defense system. And not only that, at the very beginning of this conflict, the Russian forces had stockpiles of drones, having learned from the battles in Azerbaijan and having learned already from previous battles on the periphery of Russia. So there's no possibility whatsoever that this relatively low-intensity war in Ukraine has even scratched the surface of the domestic supply mm-hmm. of Russian drones.
Good
up
point.
Until today.
Good point. I need to, since you talked about how Russian or American missiles were being rained down, John Stepling, I do have to mention something that former Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif did say about how Iraq was being provided during the 8-year war with so many weapons from Western countries that there was nobody, as he said, nobody that was providing Iran with any missiles of any kind, and bombs were being rained down on Iran, killing many Iranians. What happened? Why was there no UN action when it came to the countries providing those missiles that were bombing Iran during the 8-year war?
Because there's always a double standard. And you know, as I said earlier, we could sit here and list U.S. crimes, and the bombing of Belgrade is a perfect example. That also, the breakup of the former Yugoslavia is significant because that was the trial balloon for expanding NATO into a kind of offensive military organization. And Clinton tried it. They weren't certain public opinion was going to be on their side, but they employed the same propaganda against Milosevic and the Serbs that they are employing against Putin now. They illegally kidnapped Milosevic, took him to an ad hoc tribunal in The Hague, et cetera, et cetera. We know that story. The U.S. sees itself as immune from any prosecution. It essentially is, because it owns organizations, so-called international organizations like the UN. Russia went to the UN in 2018, by the way, asking for peacekeepers to be sent to Ukraine. They pleaded to send peacekeepers. When they finally took action this last year and went into Donbass, the people in that region saw Putin as stopping a war, not starting a war. They had endured 7 years of shelling and 14,000 civilian deaths, and this is never, ever mentioned in the Western press when they discuss the unprovoked Russian attack on Ukraine. So it's just nonsense. But you know, it's the United States that has 900 military bases around the world, nobody else. Russia has like three or something outside its borders in former satellite countries and one in Syria. The United States has 900. There's almost not a country in Africa that doesn't have a significant U.S. military base. So, you know, all of this double standard is, as I say, almost laughable, because the, you know, it just flies in the face of historical reality.
Well, let's take a look at a piece of news here that may be bad news for Zelensky. John Bosnich, and that is how U.S. Republicans have issued a statement through the House Minority Leader saying that we're not going to write a blank check for Ukraine if we take control of the House. And they said that those days are going to be over and that Ukraine is going to be facing a tough fight for getting funding from the U.S. Do you think that that is indeed what's going to happen? And what if it does, what would that spell for Ukraine and then for the whole conflict, in a sense?
Well, if that does happen, and if the Republicans regain control of the House, there's absolutely going to be an about-face on several aspects of Biden's very aggressive foreign policy, especially in Ukraine. Former President Trump was making it clear that his priority and the priority of the new Trump version of the Republican Party was going to be building the economy at home. This war is far beyond the saber-rattling that Trump used against Iran and the saber-rattling that Trump used against China. This is an out-and-out, full-scale, multi-billion-dollar expenditure from the American taxpayers' pocket to feed the companies that put Biden in power. Now, it's a question of whether the companies in America are stronger than the people of America. We'll see next month when they have their election.
Okay, final question to you, John Stepling. Are we looking at political motive when it comes to the U.S. Vis-a-vis Iran, given the fact that if we put that into the JCPOA revival talks, since that has either reached a dead end or is on life support, that maybe the electricity has taken off that, it's just not beating anymore, that perhaps they want to pressure Iran in this way. Is there a possibility of that?
Well, I suppose, you know, I suppose it's a possibility. What goes on in the brains of Biden's, you know, inner circle is anyone's guess. Remember that this, you know, Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan and Blinken and all of these people are heavily influenced by that sort of Straussian neocon philosophy that began under Reagan. We have seen this foreign policy from Democrats and Republicans alike, but I think at this point, when people see the massive protests in Europe, when they see the growing crisis of homelessness and social unrest in the United States, the unemployment figures are stunning. There's no growth. The U.S. produces nothing except despair at this point. You know, politically, the Republican Party needs to probably do, as your other guest said, an about face on a lot of Biden policies. His approval ratings are at an unprecedented low. I don't think there's ever been a U.S. president with approval ratings quite as low as Biden has right now. And he's something of a laughing stock. So pressuring Iran, you know, they pressure Venezuela, they pressure Iran, they pressure China. This is just pro forma, you know, the usual rhetoric that comes out of the White House and Washington. I don't know how much importance it has at this point. the sanctions on Iran, you know, the JCPOA has to be on the back burner at this point. You know, there's no country that doesn't constitute an almost client state. You can't find one that isn't sanctioned. Any right. sign of autonomy or disobedience, you get sanctioned. It's astounding, actually. So, okay. Yeah, I don't know. They're going to continue to demonize Iran, though. That's for certain.
Thank you very much. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. That was John Stepling from Inderøy, Norway, author and commentator. John Busnich, thank you, from Belgrade, journalist, activist, and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, criticism and admonition between friends. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, we're talking about the criticism and the admonition between friends. The relationship between friends continues for a long period of time, or even to the end of their lives. And over this period of time, they exchange their habits and morals, whether good or bad. However, committing mistakes is the nature of a human being. None of us is infallible, except those purified by the Almighty Allah. Men sometimes commit mistakes towards their Lord and towards themselves and or towards the people in their society or in the society that they're living in. Whoever has a mistake committed to him, no doubt will show his reaction, and his type of reflection differs according to the type and amount of the mistake committed, and likewise according to the person concerned. So some become angry, thereby uttering bad words, while others remain silent, as if they are unaware that a mistake has been committed. So he controls himself and continues the relationship no matter how small or big the mistake might be. Now, dealing with the mistakes of friends has its moral basis. Because when a friend commits a mistake to his friend, for instance, he directed a bad word to him. For instance, let's say, for example, a friend has directed a bad word to the other particular friend, or maybe has cheated him financially or socially. He should approach him mildly for his mistake, because exercising patience from natural mistakes of others is a major basis in a friend's life. Whoever is not able to accommodate others' mistakes automatically can never be able to live with them. But whoever crosses the limit of good morals, inflicting harm to his friend, then it is not right to take him as a friend. So one of the main things that we need to look at in a relationship between two friends is for us to make sure that we are controlling how we are criticizing the other party, the other side of our friendship.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. We're talking about the criticism between friends. Criticizing and following a friend if he or she makes a mistake is not something bad. Rather, it is obligatory. It is wajib in order to correct him so that the relationship can continue. But it is wrong to admonish your friend in all matters. or maybe to criticize him to the extent of you hurting his feelings, we must respect the feelings of our friends and present criticism in a word acceptable to them. So if we want our friend to accept our criticism, we must also accept his criticism and admonition. And we should open our hearts and mind to accept it. Because man, definitely, most of the time he commits mistakes, but sensible criticism helps in correcting and wiping out the mistakes as well as adjusting him. So we need to control how we are criticizing others, how we are speaking to them, how it's going to make them feel whenever we say a few words in form of criticizing. And this might definitely improve the relationship between two friends. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with a cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy. that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Bourizab, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process and were cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open 3 schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats. One of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rubeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rubeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The 4 Geneva Conventions, especially the 3rd Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Italia Sovrana Popolare chiede.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point, we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself. So we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month. And that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are skirting Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that. Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the subpoena was announced on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The battered town of Obeznoi. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers, but our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's interior ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Miller, Rebeznoy, Donbass.
In the limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about the FBI investigation of his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, according to the New York Times. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Salon.com has more on this story. Former President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about his alleged 2016 campaign ties to Russia. The exchange never happened, but Donald Trump floated the idea to his aides. The National Archives had pressed Donald Trump to return the documents stored at his Florida estate at Mar-a-Lago, but Trump spent a year and a half delaying their requests. He was upset with the National Archives' unwillingness to hand over the documents that ostensibly backed his claims in the Russia probe, according to the New York Times. Upon entering the White House, Donald Trump formed a habit of bringing documents back to his bedroom, according to the report. Halfway through his term in office, tracking files in the White House became an obstacle, and by his third year in office, some documents ended up in places where they should not have been, according to individuals familiar with the situation who spoke to the New York Times. At the end of his presidency, White House counsel Pat Cipollone called for Donald Trump to return documents that had piled up in boxes in the White House, according to archives officials, the New York Times reported. The top lawyer for the National Archives, Gary Stern, also demanded that Donald Trump return the classified files from Mar-a-Lago in a letter in 2021. It is also our understanding that roughly 24 boxes of original presidential records were kept in the residence of the White House over the course of President Trump's last year in office and have not been transferred to the National Archives and Record Administration, despite a determination by Pat Cipollone in the final days of the administration that they need to be, Stern wrote. Throughout the year, Gary Stern continued to press Donald Trump's team to have him hand over the boxes. He even spoke with the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and three lawyers who worked in the White House's counsel's office. At the end of last year, as Gary Stern pushed for Donald Trump to return the documents, Trump told Mark Meadows that the boxes he took from the White House merely contained newspaper clippings and personal items. Even such documents seen by Trump while in office were considered presidential records, the archives informed Donald Trump's team. Still, Trump did not return any boxes. Former White House advisor Eric Hirschman also told Donald Trump near the end of his last year that he could encounter significant legal problems if he didn't return the records to the National Archives, according to the New York Times.